the scariest bit is that element of demonising people and casting them in that role of the enemy within.
On the centenary of the end of World War I, we revisit Australia's internment camps where many ordinary citizens found themselves in detention. And
I'd never seen it this crowded. I've never had to wait in lines before, but tonight I got there about 6:45 and the lines were wrapping all the way around the gymnasium. It's at a local middle school.
Voting frenzy in the US as the midterm elections are underway. Hello and welcome to The Wire, current affairs across Australia on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Annie Hastwell in Adelaide. Also today, prison radio and how it can be a game changer for prisoners and the society they have to eventually return to. And Don Dale, the NT detention facility. Far from being closed, as the Royal Commission recommended, it's full of Aboriginal youths and at boiling point. Stay with us for the next half hour on The Wire. Well, American voters have headed to the polls today to vote in the midterm elections. A blue wave, a complete takeover of both houses by Democrats, had been predicted. But results so far are not that dramatic. The Democrats will gain control of the House of Representatives, but Republicans will remain in control of the Senate. The Wire's Chris Dastour has this report.
Millions of Americans have hit the polls in the first major electoral test of Trump's presidency and agenda. Brooklyn resident Elisa Solario cast her vote today.
I'd never seen it this crowded. I've never had to wait in lines before, but tonight I got there about 6:45 and the lines were wrapping all the way around the gymnasium. It's at a local middle school. And I've heard from other people who live in various parts of the city, from the Upper West Side to other parts of Brooklyn, that they too have never seen the polls nearly this crowded.
Midterm elections are known to have a lower turnout, but this year has already seen almost double the amount of early voting compared to 2014.
You know, particularly because Democrats could potentially flip the House in control of their party, that has motivated, at least from what I've witnessed, it's motivated a lot of people in both parties to come out and vote because there is a sense that control of the House and control of the Senate remain at stake.
Emma Shortis is a U.S. History and Politics Research Officer at RMIT University. She says, contrary to a lot of people's cynicism towards polls, they've largely been accurate so far.
So what the kind of pundits were predicting would happen seems to have actually happened, which I think people were kind of expecting might not be the case just because US politics has seemed so unpredictable. So it looks like the Democrats will take back control in the House, so in the lower house, but they won't be able to get control back in the Senate. So we'll have a split Congress.
And as you said, that had kind of been the predictions as of even yesterday. But overall, would this really be considered a blue wave like many had anticipated?
No, I don't think so. I don't think you can call it a blue wave at all. A blue wave would mean winning in states where Democrats hadn't expected to win, places like Texas, where the race for the Senate seat got very close. But in the end, the Democrats didn't get it. They got close to unseating Ted Cruz. But as far as a wave goes, that's definitely not something we're seeing.
So with the Democrats grabbing the House and Republicans still holding the Senate, how does that affect the political agenda for the next couple of years?
I think that's pretty difficult to predict. So it'll mean basically that Trump won't be able to get a legislative agenda through the lower house. So that's the kind of first obstacle for new laws. And it's unlikely that he'll be able to get much through there. But sort of having said that, he hasn't been able to get that much through since he was elected in 2016. What I think we might see is in Trump sort of increasingly ruling by executive order, so kind of issuing these orders from the White House, which again, he's already been doing. And because it looks like the Republicans have retained control of the Senate, he will still be able to do things like confirm nominees for the Supreme Court, for example. What we might see, I think, is because if Democrats win control back of the House, they'll also win back control of some pretty important committees. So a lot of the kind of legislative process in the US goes through these committees, and several of them are in the process of investigating Trump and people close to Trump. So I think we'll kind of see those investigations ramping up. We'll see more requests for documents, for information. We might see more subpoenas and that kind of thing. So in a way, I think we'll sort of see a continuation of the kind of craziness that we've seen for the last 2 years.
You mentioned Supreme Court judges before as well. Does this affect a lot of other judge positions and appointees by Trump?
Yeah, so this can affect all kinds of appointees by Trump, not just at the Supreme Court. That's the kind of highest court, but it does affect lower appointees, and it affects, you know, if for some reason he has to appoint a new Attorney General, so if he fires Jeff Sessions, which he's been intimating that he will do, he should be able to get those appointees through relatively easily because he'll have, the Republicans at least, will have control of the Senate.
And how does the election overall reflect on Trump?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think I kind of want to see the final result. But I think what we're sort of seeing is that even though American politics has kind of seemed so crazy and that things are sort of completely changed from what they used to be, what this election result is kind of showing us is that actually the political landscape hasn't changed that much.
Are there actually any individual results you found particularly shocking?
I think for me, one of the most interesting ones was in fact Texas, because Texas is a deep red state. You know, Ted Cruz was considered pretty safe, but the Democrat challenger, Beto O'Rourke, actually got, I think, closer than most people expected. You know, Texas is so deeply Republican, and for it to get that close to flipping Democrat is pretty notable, I think. But as far as that goes, you know, we sort of holding my reservation that all the results aren't in yet, I don't think we've seen anything kind of that the polls didn't predict, you know, a few days ago, even a few weeks ago.
Emma Shortis, US History and Politics Research Officer at RMIT University. She was speaking to The Wire's Chris Dastour.
No matter where I am in the world, I check in on The Wire and find out what's making news in Australia.
The Wire, current affairs on air and online, wherever you are.
Last night in Darwin, two detainees at the Dondale Youth Detention Centre broke out of their cells, set the facility's school on fire and used angle grinders to cut fences in an attempt to escape. One snatched a set of keys from a worker and the two detainees released all but one of the youths locked up in their cells in the facility. The incident has ignited demands as to why nothing seems to have changed since another controversial incident in 2014 that sparked a royal commission. The Wire's Catherine Andrews asked Amnesty International's Indigenous Rights Advisor Rodney Dillon what his reaction was to what happened last night.
I'm concerned for everyone that's involved in this. I think that, you know, when we have riots or anything like this, it's a concern for everyone on both sides to get injured in this. And I think that these things can be stopped in the first place. And we're also concerned, you know, for the Dondale place itself. It was never an acceptable place to put our people. It was a last-minute gap to put our kids, and that's all. Every kid that's in there, I think, is Aboriginal today.
Why hasn't anything changed about how youths in Dondale are being treated?
Look, I think a culture in a prison is very hard to change. I don't think a government can change the culture in a prison. I think it's we need to be calling on the people inside the prison to change that culture, and that comes through the bosses of the prison itself. That's what's got to change for the prison to change. You can't change it being the government.
Do you think last night's riot will prompt more action to close the centre down?
The problem they've got is that if they close it down, where are they going to put the kids? And, you know, there is some solutions to that, because some of the kids in there haven't been to court yet, so I'd suggest that those kids that haven't been, that are still being held in that prison, perhaps we should look at doing something else with those kids. And there's a lot of those kids in that group.
If the kids aren't in the centre, where do you think would be a better place for them to be?
We think that they should be sending them to Aboriginal-led solutions. We think that there's Aboriginal groups that's in the Northern Territory that could take these kids and help these kids a lot better than run them through a prison system. We think that Indigenous-led solutions are the way, and we know the government knows this. The government is making steps towards it. There's a few kids that's always going to have to be locked up, but not as many as we've got.
What are the best Indigenous-led solutions, in your opinion?
Well, there's Aboriginal-run programs up there. There's groups doing that already. One group in Darwin takes kids and takes these troubled kids and helps them. But I think that just putting kids in a prison system and putting them through and having waters with them, I think that system has failed and continually failed all kids. I think that we need specialists to look after these kids and address the kids' issues, not just put them in there and put them through like a factory. These kids have got to have specialist care. There's kids that's got problems in many ways, and those problems need addressing, because if you just keep putting them in there, it's like, and just keep churning them through, they'll keep going through that system. we need to address the kids' issues that they've got to stop them from going back into that place. They're the important steps, I think, that this government needs to take. And I think this government understands that. And I think this government is better than the last one, but it's still a long, you know, it didn't have much to beat. This government's got a long way to go to prove itself to get these kids up and keep the kids out of this prison system.
Do you think there's anything else the government can do to help prevent these kids from offending or reoffending in the future?
If you talk to people like Olga Havanen in the Northern Territory, she's been to Spain, she's had a look at places overseas that have got much better programs, ways of running prisons than what we've got here in Australia. Some prisons they've got over there's got very few prison officers. All the people there are specialists in their fields of addressing the issues these kids have got. That's what we need to be looking at. Couple that with Indigenous-led solutions and raising the age, and I think that, you know, that you would have we would be far better off than what we are now.
That's Amnesty International's Indigenous Rights Advisor Rodney Dillon speaking with Wire's Catherine Andrews, and we did try to get in touch with the Minister for Territory Families, Dale Wakefield, who's responsible for what's going on at Don Dale, earlier today, but she was unavailable for comment. Well, on detention again, when prisons focus on helping rather than punishing, they can help prevent criminals from reoffending. The Prison Radio Association is a UK charity that helps create radio programming by prisoners for prisoners. This helps them connect with their family and community, and it also makes it easier for them to rejoin society when they finally walk through those prison gates. Chief Executive of the Prison Radio Association, Phil Maguire, is visiting from the UK. He came into the studios today to speak with The Wire's Rowan Neagle.
There was lots of problems there. There was riots, deaths in custody, racial tension, self-harm, suicide. It was a prison with a lot of problems. And Prison Radio started there in order to give those young men and boys, something comforting to listen to when at night when they were at their most vulnerable in a cold, dark cell, and to give them something that they could feel a bit of ownership over. So it was very much a harm reduction service. But it was special and it was innovative and it was new. The BBC got interested in it, and then a partnership started between the prison service and the BBC to try and develop prison radio, and that was when I got involved. And we changed the nature of prison radio. We started making prison radio be about producing content that could add real value to the lives of people in prison, not just keep them company, not just give them comfort, but give them real information that they could act on. The challenge we have is getting prisoners to listen to speech radio because many of them are not used to doing so. But the station broadcasts a real blend of music and speech, entertainment, discussion, documentary, features, a whole range of stuff. But the main aim of the station is to support prisoners through their sentence, provide them with access to information about the services that are available to them inside and out. And the ultimate aim of what we do is to work in partnership with a range of organisations to support a reduction in reoffending.
This is also to help them engage with their communities as well, like getting their friends and family involved. How does that sort of emerge?
Our request show is probably our most popular programme, and we have special editions regularly of the family and friends request show, where family and friends can write into us and request music and send messages of love and support to their loved ones inside.
Also, I just want to touch on another program which might be a bit polarizing, which is Face to Face, which involves three victims speaking to three prisoners, typically victims of violent acts, violent crime. And these three prisoners have committed a crime similar. So it's not victims facing their offenders, it's cross similarities. How's that being received?
The programme you're talking about, Face to Face, it was a one-off programme. It was a partnership with the National Victims Charity, Victim Support. We brought into the studio the family of a young man that was beaten to death. His parents, Ray and Vi Donovan, came into the studio and spoke very passionately about their experience of losing their son. And they were sharing the tiny studio space with a small number of men who were serving sentences for extremely violent offences. And then the men in the studios gave their honest, raw reaction to what they'd just heard. And the impact on them was quite something. It was really palpable. It wasn't just the impact on them, it was the impact that it had on the wider audience. So we have an audience of more than 80,000 prisoners that listen regularly to National Prison Radio. And we know from the correspondence we received that the impact of that programme spread much, much wider than just the studio in Brixton Prison.
Does this help with the idea that you're achieving your goal of reducing reoffending through this kind of program?
That's a really good question. I don't think any single organisation can prove that it reduces reoffending, and we don't set out to do that because there are a whole host of reasons why somebody stops committing crime. And how do you measure a reduction in reoffending? Is it somebody commits lots of crime and then suddenly stops and doesn't commit any? Is it somebody who used to commit 10 crimes a day and now commits one a week? Is that a reduction in reoffending? So how do you measure it? Somebody once said to me the best way of reducing reoffending is simply waiting until people reach the age of 27, because that's when people generally stop committing crime. It's obviously a real generalization, but there can be loads of reasons why somebody might stop committing crime. They might have been involved in 20 different education courses or interventions. They might have fixed their relationship with their parents or with their spouse. They might just have got out of prison and this time had accommodation to go to, and that made all the difference. So we can't prove that we reduce reoffending, but what we do is we work in partnership with a whole range of organisations. We give a voice to those organisations and we allow them to get their messages to tens of thousands of prisoners directly in their cells in a way that no other intervention can. All of the areas that we know contribute to a reduction in reoffending, we give them a voice and we give them a wider audience.
Australia has a few prisoner radio programs, but the UK sort of association is different. What can Australia kind of learn from that?
That's a really good question. Well, we're here with Dr. Charlotte Bedford. She's one of only two doctors of prison radio in the whole world. Charlotte was alongside me all the way, and Charlotte became the second employee of the PRA and worked with us until 10 years ago.
So I've been working in community radio and prisoner radio in Australia for the last 10 years. Australia has a really strong history of community radio programming for prisoners. So it's more about a prison request show, or there are programs like Jailbreak up in Sydney, Beyond the Bars program for NAIDOC Week each year from 3CR. There's a new show over in Western Australia. That all of those are making radio programs inside. When Phil was coming over here to do the keynote address to the National Community Radio Conference this weekend, what happened there is we saw a really good opportunity so that we could share the work that we've been doing here and that Phil's been doing, and really start to build a movement of prisoner radio that we've all been starting to do in different states across the country for years. But this is a really good way for us to bring everybody together.
So wait for it. Prison Radio Across Australia coming soon. That's Dr. Charlotte Bedford, and before that, Phil Maguire from the UK Prison Radio Association in the studio with The Wire's Rowan Neagle. And speaking of radio, you're with The Wire. We go out all over Australia on community and Indigenous radio. And hello today, if you're listening on 102.9 FM in Lajamanu in the Northern Territory, part of the very wide Karma Network, on MTM FM in Coonamble in New South Wales, or maybe on 2XX in Canberra. Well, this weekend will mark 100 years since the armistice that ended World War I was signed. That war led to the practice of detaining civilians as well as prisoners of war in camps across Australia. These captured people may have been ordinary citizens, but their heritage marked them as suspicious, and they were feared as enemy aliens. Their stories are the focus of a new book called Captured Lives: Australia's Wartime Internment Camps. Author Peter Monteith told me how the Broken Hill picnic massacre, when two men claiming to represent the Ottoman Empire opened fire and killed 15 people, drove this fear of the enemy in our midst.
That was a sign that the war was coming to Australia, so shots were fired on Australian soil. At that point, that was near Broken Hill, and that led to a wave of internments there. But it was followed then later in the same year by, well, Gallipoli, of course. And after Gallipoli, news of Australian deaths at war overseas. And then in the following year comes the Western Front. And by that time, Australians fighting directly against Germans in particular. There were reports from overseas in 1915 as well about German abuse of Belgians, of civilians. And so with those sorts of reports from overseas, there was this growing antagonism towards the German community here.
It's not too hard to draw a parallel between what happens now and an act of terrorism on Australian soil, for example, like
what the Lint Cafe appeared to be, and the rise in public feeling, the rise in the need to isolate a particular community?
Yeah, certainly there are parallels there. When a community is in a declared state of war, there is always that temptation then to demonise one section of the community. And that is certainly what happened in the First World War, especially in relation to the German community, but to some extent also to communities whose background was in Austria-Hungary or the Ottoman Empire. And so, yes, we can see some very clear parallels through to the present, where we have a declared war on terror and the same sorts of suspicions that are played upon by politicians and by others. So that in the First World War, there were those who said we must intern absolutely everyone who's an enemy alien. Against that, there were others who adopted a much more reasoned approach and couldn't see the sense in treating people in that way, in alienating segments of the society. So there was a variety of responses. But yeah, from our point of view, the scariest bit is that element of demonising people and casting them in that role of the enemy within.
So let's get to those camps themselves and what internment actually meant. What was the intention with those camps? Was it to punish or was it just to isolate?
It was to isolate rather than to punish. In the way they operated, there might have been some elements of punishment as well, especially as that anti-enemy alien sentiment became stronger as the months and years went by. But primarily it was to isolate. The justification was that the people who were put there were potential security threats, and that was understandable in some cases. So if, for example, young German men taken from German vessels had been allowed to depart Australia as reservists, they would have potentially returned to Germany, enlisted in the German armed forces. So those are understandable ones in some ways. The more delicate ones, the more difficult ones, are those cases of people who were living in Australia for a long time and expressed loyalty to Australia.
And there were some really sad stories there, weren't there, of men separated from families, of families destitute because they didn't have a breadwinner anymore?
That's right. Sad for the men who were interned, and in the First World War it's primarily men. The only exceptions are some families who were brought to Australia, but it's men who are separated from their families in many cases, and those families do it extremely tough, as do the men, because the conditions inside the camps aren't very salubrious conditions at all. You know, they're quite austere, I think, is about the kindest thing that you could say about them.
What's the most unkind thing you could say about them?
Well, in the case of the Torrens Island camp, there were abuses of prisoners that were recorded at the time. So there were cases of use of bayonets, for example, in imposing discipline. There was a case of a prisoner being shot, not shot dead, but wounded. Various forms of deprivation and disciplinary actions that were quite inappropriate for the nature of those camps, because after all, these people weren't criminals. They were just identified as enemy aliens and isolated.
What's your view as an historian about that kind of thing? Does everything need to be exposed to the bright light, or should history be conveniently the light and shade that we want to see it as in the present?
I think you have to expose the darker places, and these certainly belong in that category. What people make of it, that's something else, but I think we have at least a responsibility to record that these places existed and to draw lessons from them, because as we were talking about before, there are parallels through to the present, different circumstances, but the same kinds of questions are being posed about how we deal with minority communities. So there are lessons to be learned, parallels to be drawn. And it is quite a fascinating thing to see how these issues keep coming back to us in Australian history. You know, there's a certain irony there that in Australia you'd think in a country of this size, so sparsely populated, it's an odd thing that so much of our history relates to this question of imprisonment, internment. It's a recurring theme that we need to be aware of.
Is how we started, as you point out at the beginning of the book.
That's how European settlement starts in Australia, with incarceration, and it's still a theme that's always been there and still is.
Peter Monteith, he's Professor of History at Flinders University in Adelaide. He was speaking about his book Captured Lives, Australia's Wartime Internment Camps, published by the National Library of Australia.